large genetic networks.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for having me here. Unfortunately, I only get to spend very little time here. However, in the little time that I've spent here already, I've looked through the roster of talks that you that was given to me, and it seemed that you have heard about this topic in the last few months quite a bit, at least of those of you who are long-term visitors to the Institute. So what I will add to this today is a is an approach that uses new kinds of data that people have accumulated in the last 3 or 4 years to genomic level data on both gene sequence and gene function for hundreds and thousands of genes that I hope will eventually give us some handle on robustness in biological systems. Now, if you have attended some of the talks that have been given here before, you probably have had the impression that people talk about very different things when they talk about robustness, and it is not necessarily clear what they always mean. In my view, and this is going to be the first part of the talk, it is very important to be clear about several things to keep one's definition straight when talking about robustness of biological systems. And I will first give a few examples of what I mean by robustness and the kinds of things that I'm interested in studying. Then I'll talk about how this kind of robustness relates to what people call redundancy or redundant gene functions in genetic networks. And the last part of the talk, I'll talk about some data that may shed light on the question of how much redundancy there is really in genetic networks. I understand that the format here is fairly informal, so I encourage you to ask any questions, especially clarification questions, if you feel like it. Just interrupt me. So here are a few examples of phenomena that might be related to what one might call robustness in biological systems. And the first one is a phenomenon that most geneticists actually don't even think very much about anymore. It's the kind of stuff that we teach in introductory genetics classes. And it is the observation that many mutations in diploid organisms, that is, in organisms that have two copies of a gene, mutations that eliminate the function of one of these copies are recessive. That means they don't have any phenotypic effect as long as one intact copy of a gene is still available. It's illustrated here in a case of, for the example, of a short section of a metabolic network, a metabolic pathway, which is part of glycolysis. Here are the chemical substrates that are form part of the pathway, and here are acronyms for the enzymes that encode the catalytic conversions of these substrates into each other. These enzymes are encoded by genes, and changing gene dosage drastically of each of these enzymes does not make a whole lot of difference in either the flux of metabolites through the pathway and the output, the final output in this case, the production of energy equivalents of the pathway. So you can change enzyme concentrations or gene dosage by 50% or more in some cases, and the behavior of the pathway doesn't really change very much. Now, what that means, for example, you put in X amounts of glucose into the pathway, and amount of energy equivalents that you get per unit time as an output of the pathway. Okay. For example, yeah, or NAD. Now, what that already... Yeah, there is actually now some pretty large-scale, unfortunately, in silico studies that suggest that, well, there's a number of ways in which to look at this. First of all, people have done test tube evolution experiments where they change gene dosage in these pathways and let, for example, a mutant strain compete against a wild-type strain on a particular physiological condition, and you don't see that there's any growth rate differences. Then there is... more recent computational studies that take actually not a tiny little fragment of a pathway, but let's say a catabolic reaction network of chemical reaction network comprising all of the core metabolism of an organism, and see what happens if you mess with individual reactions in the pathway. And it turns out that a large fraction of these changes don't really make a difference to the output of the pathway. There is, fortunately, and this is why I actually bring this example, this is probably about the only example where we have a reasonable understanding of a mathematical theory, where we have good mathematical models that describe the properties of these pathways in terms of flux through the pathway. These models are not perfect, but they are much better than anything that is available, for example, let's say for signal transduction pathways or the kinds of pathways that molecular biologists more often study. And that is actually a big problem. I'm going to talk about this in the context of another example here, perhaps we can. That second example that I will bring up is actually one that people are constantly much worried about, because it's the kind of experiment that a lot of people in genomics are doing right now, and perhaps we can discuss it in that context. You have a very valid point here. The possibility, there's the real question whether organismal systems, cells or whole multicellular organisms show robustness and fitness to genetic perturbations. And it's something that is extremely difficult to assess experimentally, because there could always be the one environment that you didn't know to test for, the one fitness component that you didn't know to assess or just didn't think to look for. And then especially in higher organisms, you have the problem that you usually deal with small population sizes. And that means that if you were, for example, to do these kinds of laboratory evolution experiments that people do in microbes, where you set up a mutant strain against a wild-type strain and figure out which one has higher fitness, the small population sizes make that almost impossible, because genetic drift can actually basically obscure even fairly large fitness differences in small populations. So there is a lot of technical problems with demonstrating that directly. And you have put your finger on a really important point here. The definition of robustness that I'm taking here, actually, is a much more modest one than that of robustness and fitness of an organism. It is robustness of a phenotype under a particular experimental or environmental condition. So, yeah, and that's as much as I'm going to say about this right now. I'm going to be talking about this much more later on. The second example that I would like to bring here, just to illustrate how different the kinds of contexts are in which biologists talk about robustness, is a phenomenon called genetic canalization. And it is something that has been first uncovered in the late 1950s by the famous embryologist Waddington, and has later been confirmed by a variety of classical genetic studies by people such as Randall, Dunn, and Fraser in 1960s and 1970s. And very recently, about 4 or 5 years ago, there was an example. This topic has been taken up again experimentally in Drosophila, and it has been shown what might be the molecular basis for at least some of the cases of this phenomenon that have been observed. So what is this phenomenon about? Wild populations of Drosophila, or fruit fly, and mouse often show invariant morphological characters, that is, characters that are constant across the population, that is, characters where there's simply no variation in the population. Now, one would surmise at first glance that if there is no variation on the phenotypic level in a character, then there is perhaps no molecular variation in the genes that are responsible for producing that character. That is, you have no variation on a molecular level, therefore you simply don't produce character variation. However, that doesn't seem to be the case for these and other similar examples. And how one finds out about that is by crossing suitable and often single gene mutants into these wild strains, and suddenly one sees an explosion of variation. That variation is polygenic, so it cannot be just caused by the single gene mutant that has been crossed into the strain. And it is genetic variation, and the way one finds out about that is by trying to select for increased or decreased character value or number. In this case, we're talking about characters like meristic characters like bristle numbers or whisker numbers. One can select for increased or decreased numbers of these characters in these modified populations very, very easily, and that suggests that this variation is really genetic. So you have basically a situation where in wild population of these organisms, you have very little variation on the phenotypic level of a character, in other words. But the reason for that is not absence of genetic variation. It's genetic variation. There is genetic variation there, but it's somehow hidden. It is somehow obscured in development. That is, during development, the process that you might call buffering takes place, where the developmental genes responsible for producing a character cooperate in such a way as to not let this variation show up on the phenotypic level. The third example is one that has attracted an enormous amount of attention recently. It is the fact that knockout mutations, mutations that eliminate gene functions in various organisms, ranging from microbes to vertebrates, often are phenotypically neutral, and by that I mean they simply don't have an easily observed effect or an effect that can be observed under any circumstances that people can think of in the laboratory. The most prominent example in this case are some large-scale studies that have been done in the yeast Saccharomyces cerevisiae, where hundreds or thousands of genes have been knocked out in individual experiments. So what these studies do is basically to take a laboratory strain of yeast, and they would say, take all genes on chromosome 5 or on some other chromosome. Chromosome 5, for example, has roughly 260 genes, and they will generate 260 mutant strains in each of which one of these genes has been eliminated. Then they test the growth rate and often also other measures of fitness, such as sporulation efficiency or mating efficiency of these strains. These mutant strains against the wild type, either in batch culture or in chemostats that can resolve fairly fine growth rate differences. And depending on the study that one consults, between 20% and 30% of these knockout strains have no detectable phenotypic effect. Now, the issue that you raised a few minutes ago applies just as well to these kinds of studies. There can always be an environmental condition that you haven't studied, or some fitness components that you haven't thought of. So you can never be sure, by a direct experimental approach, that you are actually detecting a fitness difference between a wild type and a mutant strain. It's just not impossible. There is some molecular evolution approaches that one can take, and I've actually tried to pursue one of those in my lab, and have actually not been very, very successful for various technical reasons. In a chemostat, you can resolve growth rate differences, I believe, of about 10^-4. Yes. However, this is an issue that is made technically complicated by the fact that in large populations, very small fitness differences can be evolutionarily important. So there is some basic, very basic statements that, and well-established statements of evolutionary theory about how population sizes influences minimal population selection coefficients that can play a role, and usually, and these selection coefficients go as an inverse of 4 times the population size. So if you have a population of 10 to the 7 individuals, you may actually selection coefficients different by about 10 to the minus 7 may make a difference on an evolutionary time scale. Yes? Yeah, that's done. That's the kind, that's the way these experiments are done. And the problem is that that doesn't really help very much, because there could be a different environment where they actually, you actually see a difference. And even if you don't see a difference, such as in case of these experiments, then it could be that you, the resolution of your experiment is just not high enough. Walter. Has to, I'm pretty sure it has not been done on this kind of scale. Okay, so whether it would be true, I'd have to think about that. Because what you'd usually do in overexpression experiments, when you express a gene ectopically, you express it not specifically in a tissue where it normally doesn't have a function, or in a part of the cell where it normally doesn't have a function, but you express it all over the place. So potentially, the problem with overexpression studies is they, well, my hunch would be that they actually lead to more severe phenotypic effects, but it hasn't been done on a large scale level. Yeah.
The species problem in biology, in terms of the fact that, you know, if you have so many beetles equals one, so many beetles equals five, so many beetles equals three times, how do you extrapolate back to how many beetles are for zero times? So I'm wondering if you have 80% of mutations that have changes in X, and you could do some kind of statistical study what the percentage of having an X value of 0.001.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, these kinds of things are done in, I'm not very familiar with the kinds of studies, but people are trying to actually measure the distribution of selection coefficients generated by point mutations, and they look roughly exponential, if I recall that. So you have a lot of mutations with very weak effects, and then very few mutations with strong effects. And I'm just not sure whether, I think it's an interesting idea, I'm just not sure whether most biologists would buy the idea that you can extrapolate to the zero class. I'm not sure how one would argue for that, if that is possible. Any more questions at this point? Yes. Explain that again to me. Yeah, this is actually an approach that is commonly pursued, and I'm just starting a collaboration with a group at the University of Toronto, from where I just came, that are doing exactly that kind of analysis on a very, very large scale. What you're talking about is referred to in yeast genetics as the technique of generating synthetic lethals. You take a mutant strain that has one gene whose function has been messed with, or its function has been eliminated by a knockout experiment, and then you screen for mutations in other genes that affect organismal function in this particular genetic background. So you basically generate looking for double mutations that have a more severe effect than single mutations. And this has now been done actually for all pairwise mutations in yeast. So people are screening for about 18 million. Yeast has about 6,000 genes, and there's about 18 million possible pairwise mutations. And you know, using large robotic approaches, large robots to manipulate the required number of plates and cells, this can now be done. It turns out that, very interestingly, if you, for example, ask how many hits do you get, that is, in any particular genetic background where a single gene mutant is viable, how many double mutants do you get that have a reduced growth rate or fitness or whatever you might want to call it, then you usually find only to about 30 to 60 additional genes that, when mutated in this double mutant background, have reduced fitness. So it's by far not true that if you have a genetic background where one gene is mutated, then suddenly hundreds or thousands of additional mutational effects pop up if you mutate hundreds or thousands of genes. Does that make sense? This is in the process of being started. This group is now, takes about, I think, 2 days with the robots they have right now, 2 days to generate one synthetic lethal screen. And it's very clear from what they've done so far that there is a distribution here, that there is particular genes that produce actually no hits, for example. So you have one mutant gene in the strain already, and there is no synthetic lethals at all. And there is some that may have 100 or so hits. What one could say about the nature of this distribution, I think it's too early. The data is really not in yet. Any other questions at this point? Okay. Now, so these three examples, in my view, illustrate that one has to be very clear about what one refers to when one talks about robustness. First of all, one has to talk about a particular property that is robust, such as in the case, for example, of metabolism, the flux rate through metabolism, or here, the growth rate in a chemostat of a microbe. Then the kind of perturbation that one has in mind, for example, the change in gene dosage at a particular locus, or here, the elimination of two copies of a gene in a diploid organism or one copy in a haploid organism. And then the resolution to which one wants to actually push this. As we already came out in this discussion, it's probably not reasonable to expect that we can absolutely resolve fitness differences. But what we can say is that under particular environmental conditions, we get very broad distribution of mutational effects. And that is quite an interesting example, quite an interesting case in and by itself. Perhaps not so much from an evolutionary standpoint, but from an engineering standpoint. If you, for example, view these cells as machines, right, then this observation alone suggests that these cells are very different. These machines are very different from the kinds of machines that humans make, in the sense that most human machines show what the engineers call, some of you may actually know this better than I do, ungraceful degradation of performance. That is, if you take out a part of the machine, the whole machine ceases to function. And although these many mutants may actually have some subtle defects in cellular function, by and large, they grow fine and do fine in actually several environmental conditions. So many of these have really very, very subtle defects. So perhaps human engineers might actually learn something from how, in the long run, from how these biological machines achieve robustness. Now, what I'll be talking about in the second half of this talk is, well, not sure whether we are in the second half already here, but what I want to talk about is two candidate mechanisms for that might be responsible for the kind of robustness that we see in these large-scale knockout experiments. So we'll focus on these experiments and how we might resolve which of those mechanisms is more important. This illustrates the kind of mechanism that is currently, if you ask most molecular biologists, they would probably argue that this is the predominant mechanism responsible for robustness in knockout experiments. And it is what people call overlapping gene functions or genetic redundancy. This is illustrated with here with an example that I've just taken from the literature. The example shows two embryos of Drosophila, one in during the blastoderm stage, early in embryonic development, and two other embryos later during neurulation. And it shows the expression patterns of where mRNA and protein is expressed for two genes. One, KNIRPS related, one a gene called KNIRPS, important developmental gene in this organism, and another one called KNIRPS related. So these black or darkly colored regions are regions where these genes are turned on. What you don't see here is that these genes are very closely related in DNA sequence and therefore also in the amino acid sequence of their gene products. And not surprisingly to many biologists, if you eliminate one of them, in fact either one, the development of the fly does proceed normally. The fly is viable and for all people can detect, it's also fertile. Okay? So having only one copy of either of these genes doesn't really make much a difference to the fly, much of a difference to a fly, apparently. And this phenomenon is really, really very frequent. So depending on how you measure it, but from microbes to organisms, genomes consist of between 30 and 50% of duplicated genes, and byproducts of recombination processes inject new duplicate genes constantly into genomes. Gene duplication is one of perhaps the dominant mode of genome evolution and is a mode of evolution that provides constantly new genes for a genome. Therefore, one would expect that this kind of redundancy in genetic systems is extremely prevalent, and perhaps it might be the predominant cause of robustness in knockout experiments as we see it. It's often not known, okay? Often what, but in the studies where this has been done, it is often found that the knockout of both genes has an effect. I believe in this specific case, only one of the knockouts has been done. So either, I'm not sure whether this or this one has been knocked out, or whether both of them have been knocked out individually, but the double knockout phenotype, I think, is not known. One has to realize that in many organisms, these kinds of experiments are not easy to do. So this is not something you do between breakfast and lunch in the laboratory. For example, until a few years ago, there were only 20 knockout mutations in mice, for example, where this technology was really very difficult to, where knockout mutations were very difficult to achieve for many years. The situation, I think, has improved, but it's still a difficult kind of experiment to do in many organisms. It's only in organisms like yeast where there's particularly well-developed molecular techniques and where the biology of the organism seems to aid, seems to help a little bit, that one can generate knockouts on a large scale and fairly easily. Now, I said gene duplications. By the way, just to back up one step, if you actually look into what human engineers do to provide machines with human engineered systems with robustness against failure of their parts, they do something that is very similar to this type of redundancy. There is, human engineers, of course, think about these problems. There are entire fields, for example, huge literature in electrical engineering called reliability theory, what makes machines reliable, fail-proof to failure in their components. And most of the answers that you'll find in those books is that you just put in many, many parts that do the same thing, okay, these machines. Now, yes? Mm-hmm. So don't fail all at the same time.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, too bad biological systems don't have that luxury, right? Now, as I said, recombination processes constantly inject new gene duplicates into genomes. Now, what one might think, therefore, is that only fairly recently duplicated genes that are young, where the two duplicates have still very similar, similar things in a cell, might be the cause of such robustness. As gene duplicates age, usually their DNA sequence and the amino acid sequence of the gene products diverges, and therefore they adopt this similar function. However, there is many examples of very, very old gene duplicates that are biochemically very carefully studied, where redundancy has been maintained or similar functions have been maintained among the duplicates. And I'm going to say this because it's somewhat important for what I'll be talking about later in the context of yeast. These are two members of larger gene families in yeast that whose biochemical function is very well characterized. For example, these are the catalytic subunits of an important protein kinase involved in regulating cell responses to nutrient, to the environment, to nutrient concentrations in the environment. These two gene pairs are important regulators of the cell cycle, where people really know very well what they're doing. Knockouts of any of these members have very weak or non-existent effects, but these gene duplicates are very, very old. What is shown here is a measure of divergence of these gene duplicates that I will be using a lot later on, and it is the fraction of what we call a fraction of synonymous substitutions at synonymous sites in these genes. It's roughly speaking a comparison of the third codon positions of the coding regions of these genes, and one estimates how many nucleotide changes have occurred at these third codon positions. This is a better measure than comparing amino acid divergences because it is under fewer selective constraints and thus agrees a little better, or the accumulation of these changes has a better correlation with elapsed time since a duplication event. Now, there's huge problems and huge error margins with getting these estimates, and especially the kinds of estimates that I will be using that are very, very high. I know some of you are very familiar with these kinds of measures of divergence, and they will see that these estimates are highly problematic. What I'm going to say here in my defense is that I will use them down the line only to group genes very roughly, gene duplicates very roughly into age categories. All I want to point out with these numbers is that, oh, something very important that I haven't said. In yeast, very roughly, AKS equals 1 indicates about 100 million years since the duplication event. Okay. And again, there is huge error margin, so it could be give or take 50 million years in this case. All this suggests is that these gene duplicates have not arisen just yesterday. They have been around for a long time, and they still have conserved their similar function for a long time. In this case, okay, these are, you probably find 100 papers on each of these genes in the literature. So these are exceptionally well studied, and it's very unlikely that people have, that these are still doing something that people have not been all over yet. Yes? Yes, very roughly speaking. Yes? Similar? Okay. I like to postpone that question because I'm going to get to that whole problem. That's a big problem, and part of the third half of the talk is going to be about that. They would be of the order of 70 to 90%. I have 70 to 90% amino acid identity. Now, there's a second possible there's a second possible mechanism that might provide this kind of robustness in knockout experiments. The problem is we don't really understand it very well, except for a case of metabolic networks. And it is what you might call epistasis or nonlinearity or cooperativity in interactions among genes that are not related by duplication. I'll illustrate it again with the case of this small section of a metabolic pathway where you have individual substrates in the pathway that are transformed, changed into each other through enzymes. And as I said before, you can change enzyme concentrations by a wide margin in these pathways without any obvious obvious phenotypic effects. Now notice that there is no redundancy involved here in the sense that I talked about in the previous transparency. That is, none of these gene products are products of duplicated genes. They are all completely unrelated evolutionarily, yet the pathway as a whole is quite resilient against changes in dosage of individual genes or concentrations of individual gene products. This actually has also been observed in these much larger metabolic network studies where one can completely eliminate individual enzymatic reactions, and where it turns out the network reroutes the flux of metabolites through different pathways. And again, there is no redundancy involved in these cases simply because these gene products don't have the same function. Now, it's a little difficult to, we only really understand this kind of process in the case of metabolic networks and in a very few other cases. Not for most of the pathways, for example, signaling pathways that molecular biologists are very interested in. So I'll take this sort of just as an anecdotal example of what this is about. But the point stands that there's two completely different mechanisms that might be responsible for this sort of robustness that we see. The first is a redundant gene functions, and the other one is this kind of what you might call the nonlinear response characteristics of a of a dynamical system, because that's what it essentially is. The dynamical system whose state variables are protein concentrations and where one is interested metabolite fluxes and how they change as a function of the change in these state variables. Now, somebody who would understand understands more about metabolic control theory than I do could tell you this. Could actually give you a more informed answer to this question. However, it seems that most folks who are studying the metabolic control of such pathways these days argue that that control of a pathway through rate-limiting steps is a myth. That's not really something that is really very important. It is important to it is important in the sense that it causes the pathway to be far from equilibrium. That is, if you put in a if you put in a certain amount of initial substrate, it will be quantitatively converted at about 100% to the end product. But that fact, that can be caused by only one irreversible reaction, but that fact doesn't really have much to do with the control of the pathway. The control of the flux through the pathway is actually distributed across all the enzymes in the pathway. Yes.
Your argument wouldn't apply to something where it's the flux that is limited rather than the concentration of
explain why that is a counter argument again to me. I'm not quite sure if I get that.
Well, I don't understand the other argument so well. It seems to me that if you were arguing on the basis that it was a an equilibrium situation and it doesn't work out, we know it's not an
equilibrium. I see what you're saying. No, I'm not actually arguing that this is because of this is an equilibrium situation here. Okay.
If I was going to
it's clear that equilibrium situations apply. But if you don't contend that it's that hopefully it might be a dynamic steady state.
No, I'm sorry, I didn't express that very well. Okay, it's certainly, almost certainly a, these kinds of pathways are almost certainly in a dynamic steady state. Okay. Now, what you seem to suggest is that perhaps there is only one enzyme in the pathway that is critical, right? And that is that might be the rate-limiting one that is also critical in the sense that if we change the concentration of that one, right? And that is not what is generally observed in these pathways. So for example, and this is something that agricultural biotech companies are very, very interested in. They want to engineer these pathways in such a way that they produce more output in a microbe, let's say. Yeah. And the classical approach would be exactly what you suggest and what most biochemists, I think, would assume, that you have a one particular enzyme that is rate limiting, you find that enzyme, you increase its activity, you increase its expression level, etc. Whatever you, however you want to mess with that enzyme, and that should increase the total output of the pathway, and that is not necessarily what is observed. It's usually not at all what is observed, in fact. You have to increase collectively all the concentrations or activities of the enzymes, otherwise you don't see all global output of the pathway, and actually you in most, if you look at wild-type strains of most microbes, I think, I'm not sure what I recall this correctly, but what you often observe is that you, by increasing the concentration or activity of only a small fraction of enzymes in a pathway, you very rapidly hit a point of highly diminished returns where you actually can't increase the output of the pathway overall very much anymore. So this, This is just to say that increasing the concentration or activity of one particular enzyme doesn't really help very much.
Those cofactors, like the NAD and the ATP, are also regulators of these steps. If the cell has some way of deciding whether or not it's got enough flux, and if it hasn't, it changes the cofactor concentration.
Yes, so and that is, yeah.
Something is on the cofactors and it's on the enzyme.
That that is a possibility. I concede that, no question about it. Now, where people, let me think about this for a second, because you know, the metabolic control folks are of course aware of this. This is probably okay. This is probably one of the cases. You know, ATP, for example, being such of such global importance that you cannot really mess with its concentration in the cell very much. Okay. And this might be one of the examples where there is a real trade-off here. You can perhaps make a pathway like that robust to changes in individual enzyme concentrations, but you can't make the cell very robust against against fluctuations in ATP or NAD concentrations. And that is something where you have limitations to how you could achieve robustness or to what degree you could do that. Does that make sense?
It also seems just that there would be very little selective pressure on an enzyme to be any better than necessary for it to be about equal to the other rate-limiting steps in the reaction pathway.
Yeah, although in detail that can be a really tricky argument. Okay. Phew.
Think of a simplification that at the level of the reaction flow, I can think of this as a local bifurcation. I can be the rest of the line and have these two possibilities, so I can knock out one of them. So this is a more of a non-local, I think that the rerouting makes it more complex.
And you have just,
But I mean, I could imagine a whole continuum between this sort of very local and very non-local.
Right. And you're perfectly correct in assuming, in stating so. The issue is, however, that molecular biologists, usually when you think about redundancy or redundant gene functions caused by gene duplications, you think about the most local of these options. That is, you really have two things in this machinery that do the same, that carry out the same function. Yeah?
Thinking about the flux through these pathways and whether you can optimize one or another, I think it's also important to consider the interaction
biases as a lot of these intermediate
mm-hmm.
enzymes.
Right.
And so if you dramatically change one enzyme mm-hmm. and lower the concentration of some of these intermediates mm-hmm. in the process of trying to just focus on the flux,
mm-hmm.
you could then mess up biases.
Yeah, and those are the kinds of things that people are trying to do. Usually it turns out, you know, however, you can't really get away with just modifying one enzyme. It's a little more complicated than that. But I agreed you have, you know, have serious trade-offs there. By the way, this is why I think these kinds of systems, although nobody's really paying much attention to them these days, are really, really interesting because we understand something about them. We understand we have a little bit of kinetic theory. And we can potentially predict the behavior of very large networks in that case, which we cannot do for the systems that people seem to be most interested in about them. For example, everything other than metabolism. Now, so what I'll propose now is a hypothesis by which we could distinguish which of these two mechanisms might be more prevalent or more important on a genome-wide scale. That is, if we were to look at the result of a large number, perhaps hundreds or thousands of knockout studies, could we find what is responsible for the weak phenotype of knockouts in most of these cases? Or what accounts for most of the weak phenotypes of knockouts that we see? Is it gene duplications, redundant gene functions, or is it something else? And here is the basic idea of the hypothesis. It basically relies on having available multiple different pairs of gene duplicates with varying degrees of similarity in sequence and expression pattern. Okay. So assume you have a single copy gene that has a function that is important for the organism. You would expect that its knockout effect should be severe. If that gene, as happens for many and most genes, undergoes a duplication at some point in evolution, you have two identical copies of this gene in the organism. And in many cases, if you eliminate one of the two copies, you would see no phenotypic effect of this mutation. After millions of years elapse, these genes accumulate changes in their DNA sequence, and their gene products accumulate changes in the amino acid sequence. So one could argue by proxy, so to speak, that their functions also diverge from initially completely identical functions to perhaps overlapping functions to some extent, and then to completely distinct functions. Correspondingly, one would expect that the effect of a knockout mutation should go from none to weak to severe. Now, we're now getting to the question again that you asked before. How can we actually be sure that, how can we actually compare two genes' functions, right? They are supposed to be different. So you have to see this is sort of the arrow of time here, and as time elapses, this is not a really very helpful. I agree that there is. I'll be glad to take suggestions for improved color schemes of this slide afterwards. So, I want to talk a little bit for a moment about the question that you raised before about how could we actually address the question, or how could we compare gene functions? And this is really a very difficult question because, first of all, we don't really have a good way of classifying gene functions, right? This is, you know, it's very clear from all the genome projects that classification of gene functions is a huge mess. You could do the classification biochemically, you could do it biologically, you could do it according to cellular compartments in which genes play a role. This is a really difficult problem. In what is now going to be the fourth half of this talk, I think I'm going to suggest a very crude way in which we might actually address this problem. However, for now, what I'm going to do is what everybody else is going to do, what everybody else is doing in this area. We take sequence similarity and the similarity in expression pattern of genes as a proxy for similarity in function. So we just say if we compare many, many gene duplicates, then We'll just assume that there is similarity in DNA sequence, amino acid sequence of the protein, of the respective proteins, and the similarity in expression pattern gives us a hint of how what similar things they might do in the cell. Yeah, go ahead. I know there's a lot of problems with that. And you're
well, there are a lot of problems with that, but just even going back to that a little bit, I mean, one of the problems is that in that process that you've described, diversification, you've sort of almost described it as a bit of a drift process in a sense, and maybe that's the motivation for the team. Yes, but in fact, I mean, it, you can't actually maintain gene duplicates without some diversification.
Yes.
There's some, I think, the guy from Australia and guy sort of showed, I mean, there's a delay in the rate of knocking out these things in this situation, but eventually either they've got that new function or diversification of function, or they're going to go.
Or there's a dosage effect.
Yeah, but the dosage effect has to be selected. And
Right, but they read it.
And then there's also other ways to compensate for that dosage.
Okay, I don't have a problem with that. Why do you see that as a problem, or is it just a comment that you're making? I think that is something that we'll observe for 99% of the genes that are around, gene duplicates that are around. They have somewhat different functions. Think about overlapping gene function in the following sense. Don't think about it in terms of an enzyme. Okay? I think enzymes are perhaps not very good examples for this, but think of a transcription factor, right? Think of a transcription factor, a gene encoding a transcription factor that we now know that many transcription factor coding genes regulate the expression of 50, 100, and 150 other genes, right? You duplicate a gene that encodes a transcription factor, then both of these duplicate genes initially will regulate exactly the same spectrum of downstream genes, right? As they diverge in function, as they diverge in sequence, the spectrum of genes that they co-regulate will change, right? It may, after some time, only overlap and then be completely distinct. So those are the kinds of examples that I prefer to think about when thinking about overlapping gene function. It's something that we might actually be able to quantify even.
That have lots of things like transcription factors and other things that are much more specific, like enzymes.
And that's quite a good possibility. I just don't know how to address that question with the kind of data that we have available currently.
By the way, it's normal to have a break sometime around 11 o'clock. A good stopping point.
Okay. What I'm going to do then is just... Yeah, I'll give myself five more minutes and then... Then we'll take that break. So what I'm proposing is the following hypothesis. If we could look at many gene duplicates, then we should be able to establish a correlation between the severity of a knockout effect and the divergence, both in DNA sequence or amino acid sequence among the duplicates or in expression pattern, that would establish that more highly diverged gene duplicates should have more severe effects when one of the genes in the set is knocked out than less diverged ones. So here is just to paraphrase this hypothesis. If overlapping gene functions caused by gene duplications are largely responsible for robustness, then we would expect a correlation between similarity among duplicated genes and phenotypic effects of loss of function mutations in one of those genes. What kind of data can one actually use to do that? And there's actually several different avenues of testing this hypothesis. I'm going to stick with yeast for now because there is just so much genomic data that has been accumulated in the last few years. What this shows here is an overview of the 16 chromosomes of yeast. And on these chromosomes are indicated the results of a study published by Wolf and Shields in Nature in 1997 that indicated that yeast has undergone a genome duplication between 100 and 150 million years ago. Okay? And the remnants of these genome duplications are large duplicated blocks of genes. For example, so there's each of these blocks comes in pairs. There's one here on chromosome 10 that has a corresponding partner, which I believe is this one on chromosome 1. And the same holds for all of these blocks, about 55 blocks of pairs. Within each of these blocks, you have, that is, you have those blocks consist of duplicated genes. That is, the first gene of this block here would have a counterpart in this block that is duplicated. The second one has a counterpart in this block that is duplicated. And the order of genes in these blocks has been preserved since the genome duplication. By the way, there is quite a bit of circumstantial evidence that suggests that this was a duplication of the genome, the whole genome, and not just a duplication of individual groups of genes. For example, if one carries out an analysis of variants on the divergence of proteins and genes within these blocks, one does not find any evidence that these duplicated blocks have different ages. Okay. So here we have a data set that provides us actually with a lot of information on gene duplicates in yeast. It's important to realize at this point that these gene duplicates are not the only gene duplicates in yeast. Okay, yeast has a fairly high rate of gene duplication, so the genome is literally littered with gene duplicates outside these duplicated blocks. And I'll talk a little bit about those later on. What I will be focusing on is a particular set of duplicated gene blocks on chromosome 5. There are six duplicated blocks of genes, comprising a total of about 50 genes. So for example, here you have a block labeled number 28. It has a block of paralogous or duplicate partners on chromosome 10 that is in the same relative orientation with respect to the centromere, which is indicated here, and so forth for some of these other blocks. So here we have 50 gene duplicates on chromosome 5. And the reason why I'm actually choosing chromosome 5 is because of this experimental data that is illustrated as an overview here, published about 4 years ago. This is a schematic overview of chromosome 5 with all its genes. So this will be the left end of the chromosome. This will be the right telomere of the chromosome. I don't see the centromere here right now, but it's somewhere in there. Each of these blocks indicates a gene or an open reading frame. And color-coded in each of these blocks is the phenotypic effect of knocking each of these genes out. The blue, a bar, would indicate no detectable phenotypic effect in 5 different media in a competition assay like the one that you asked about. Red bars would indicate the most severe phenotypic effect. 40% of the knockouts in these genes had no phenotypic effect. And interestingly, while one can certainly make the case that, as you did, that you can never be sure that adding a new environment in which to carry out the competition between a wild type and a mutant may actually reveal differences, these kinds of growth assays have been done in 5-6 different environments, and most of the effects of knockouts are actually general for all environments. About 90% of the knockout effects are not environment specific. So now, here we have a data set where we have information on duplicates on chromosome 5 and knockout effects of these duplicates on chromosome 5. And then I think this is a good time to take the break, and I'll show you some of the results of this analysis after the break. So just to remind you, the hypothesis that I'm interested in is to find out whether similarity in sequence and or expression patterns of duplicated gene pairs within these paralogous blocks of genes is correlated with the fitness of the growth rate defect of a knockout mutation. So one can first simply look at measures of sequence similarity, both on amino acid or DNA, and there's just 3 of them that I used. I used several more many of them much more subtle than the ones that are shown here, such as the estimated fraction of amino acid substitutions per site. However, the result doesn't really depend in any way on the kinds of measures that you're using. That is, if you plot what is shown here on the x-axis, and I simply call this fitness effect, but it's positively misleading. This is not a fitness effect of a knockout. It's just a growth rate defect as detected by this assay, ranging from zero to, that is, no effect, to three, most severe effect. The authors divided the range of effects they observed in four categories, realized that this is not the optimal. This is not a very sophisticated way of doing this, but this is the kind of data that we have available, and that's just the way our data sets are right now. And tries to correlate it with measures of DNA or amino acid identity. One doesn't see any statistical association whatsoever, and doesn't really depend on what measures of similarity one really uses here. Pardon? In the first upper panel was amino acid identity, but you can use DNA similarity by various measures, the rate of synonymous and non-synonymous substitutions, whatever you choose to use, this works. There is no statistical association. Now, especially in higher organisms, we do know of quite a few cases where gene duplicates, the biochemical function of the duplicates is virtually identical. All they have done is that diverged in expression pattern. That is, they're turned on at different parts at times during organismal development, for example, and that is all that causes them to have different biological functions. And now the yeast is a single-celled organism, so you really can't go about, do much of a spatial analysis, although to some extent one can do that, a spatial analysis of expression pattern, but one can actually look at temporal changes in expression pattern. There are several very large data sets that determined the changes in expression state messenger RNA expression of all yeast genes, 6,000 yeast genes, during three different physiological or life cycle critical stages in yeast. The first one is the dioxic shift, that is the change from aerobic to from anaerobic to aerobic metabolism. Second one is sporulation, and the third one is the cell cycle. So we actually have time series comprising of about 150 measurements total for each gene that document the changes in expression patterns during these three stages of yeast life cycle. And one can then simply ask the question, do these duplicate genes, duplicate gene pairs, does the similarity in the time course of expression of duplicate gene pairs correlate in any way with the growth rate defect of a knockout? And this is a slide very similar to what I've shown before for sequence comparison. That is, on the x-axis, you have the growth rate defect of a knockout. On the y-axis, you have measures, several different measures of similarity in expression, some parametric, some non-parametric. The result is unequivocally the same regardless of what measures you use. There is no statistical association between severity of a knockout and similarity in expression course time change. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Actually, if you look, if you look at this carefully, you actually see that, if you want to read anything into this pattern, which I don't really want to do, that the line actually goes the wrong way. That is, duplicate genes with more severe fitness effects when knocked out actually have more similar expression patterns, right?
Okay. A pair of genes which you know are homologous, which you
right.
know are duplicated.
Right.
And you ask the question, how similar are their expression levels of the y axis?
Mm-hmm.
And if you knock one of them out,
mm-hmm.
what is the magnitude of the change in fitness?
Right.
And
right.
Okay.
Right. And so you might actually ask yourself, well, perhaps this is not sufficient. Perhaps we really can do this only for the genes that are both very conserved in DNA sequence or amino acid sequence on one hand, and in their similarity in expression patterns. So this is a group of about 10 most conserved gene pairs in both of these respects. It's too small to really make any statistical argument here. However, what one notices and recall that zero means no effect when knocked out, three means maximum effect. If anything, these have a larger than average, than normal effect when knocked out. And the reason is actually something that has to do with the biology of these genes. Many of them are actually encode ribosomal proteins. Ribosomal proteins have the peculiar feature that they're extremely highly expressed. That changes in gene dosage are absolutely critical. Changes in gene dosage raise huge problems in maintaining protein synthesis functions, because they simply change the number of ribosomes that can be produced in a cell during a given amount of time. So if you actually eliminate one of two completely identical copies of a ribosomal protein coding gene, then you really mess with protein synthesis of the organism. Yes?
Similarly, we should talk about the two genes. They're 100% identical in terms of their protein content. Still not allowed. One of them is not, they're not completely irreplaceable.
That's what I was just talking about. It's a dosage effect. Okay. For those particular types of genes, the concentrations of the product is absolutely critical to the cell. Now, right.
Because you have effects.
Right. However, this is a minority. I should emphasize that this fraction of very highly expressed genes is a minority. It's a very small minority. So I think it's not going to influence the overall results significantly. For example, I've not looked at this with respect to this duplicate set very carefully, but there is only a good way of measuring gene expression levels. Is through the codon usage bias. It's basically a measure of how strong the preference for particular equivalent codons in a genetic code is in a particular gene. Okay. And it turns out that of the gene sets that I use in these kinds of analysis, only 4 or 5% of the genes have a codon usage bias that is statistically significantly different from random, suggest that they are highly expressed. So this is not likely to be a big confounding problem, this kind of analysis.
I'm just wondering if there could be a continuous range of dosage effects, and any residual small dosage effects would tend to affect the confounding correlation.
I think there is, in general, this is a problem. It is also a problem because we know that some very lowly expressed genes show dosage effects, okay, for reasons that are not quite clear. It's very difficult to address with the kinds of data that we have right now. Okay.
The one where you showed and indicated that the line went the wrong way, given that the hypothesis was that the more divergent they were, the more they should be affected, then you've got what can be a one tail test. And instead of giving the hypothesis, probability of achieving is not 0.09, is that more like 0.91?
No, actually, I took care to eliminate that problem. Actually, I don't remember the details of how I did the test, but I'm pretty confident that that's not an issue there. I'll be happy to talk about this with you afterwards. It's a technical detail, although it's an important one. I agree. Yes.
And therefore, the ones that actually diverging the least, you might think, if those are the most important genes, they're also the most likely to suffer deleterious effects when you
There's all I'm really the I see what you're saying there. All I'm really addressing, trying to address here, is the question of, you know, is this naive, what I consider now a naive hypothesis, that gene duplicates are responsible for weak effects of knockout mutations? Is that, does that really hold up if we look at it for large sets of duplicated genes? What, you know, how do you measure the importance of a gene in an organism? That certainly, there's a variety of ways of looking at that. I had actually fully gone into this kind of analysis with the full expectation you would see this kind of correlation between knockout effect and similarity among duplicated genes. So I was really disappointed when that didn't really turn out to be the case. Yes?
Well, could you, in a sense, correct for that by looking at how divergent these genes were from other organisms?
Not for yeast, because the issue of, you know, the there is not a clearly resolved phylogeny within this group of fungi, and it's not really, we have very small gene samples from related organisms, so it's a comparative study would clearly be the way to go, but we don't have the sufficient phylogenetic resolution to really do that at this point. But there are several genome projects going on in filamentous and non-filamentous fungi right now, and they will probably help us resolve these kinds of questions. Pardon?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm not sure what I actually should go into this at this point, because I'm running a little short on time. But basically, the story is this, that, or the prevailing hypothesis at this point is that in cells you have unequal distribution of tRNA pools. Those are the tRNAs that are responsible for translating individual codons into amino acids. If a gene should be maximally expressed by a cell, it should have codon usage for particular amino acids that corresponds to the tRNA pool. And this is in general what one observes also. Genes that have highly biased codon usage, that is, that use particular codons that presumably match the tRNA, prevailing tRNA very well, they also are generally observed to be very highly expressed. Ribosomal proteins are one of the prime examples. They have extremely high codon usage bias and are also very highly expressed. In fact, they propose huge problems in microarray analysis, because their signal is so strong that they actually cause, the signal leaches into surrounding areas of the array, thereby obscuring other genes' expression signals. Yes.
And it is tending towards the bias that prevails in the pool of tRNA in that cell.
Yes.
So from the point of view of the tRNA, is it's unbiased. It's sort of equalized.
Exactly.
The
yeah.
But it's biased with respect to the null hypothesis that all codons are equal.
Exactly. And for lowly expressed genes, you actually observe equal codon usage or unequal with respect to the tRNA pool. Whichever way you choose to look at that. So I actually redid this kind of analysis using gene duplicates also outside the duplicated blocks, and the result was pretty much the same. And at that point, I was very unpleasantly surprised by this result. So I tried to look at it from yet another angle. I asked the question, try to get at this hypothesis from yet another angle. That is, I thought, well, perhaps we are thinking about this whole problem the wrong way. Maybe it is not pairs of duplicated genes, but it is whole gene families that are responsible for compensating the knockout effect of one of their members. And we know that those gene families like that is whole groups of 3, 5, 10, 20 or more closely related genes, are prevalent in most eukaryotic genomes. So what I basically did to address this question, I'm not going to go through the whole analysis, I'm just going to show you a part of it, is I divided those genes, the genes on chromosome 5, into two classes. Those that had a wild-type effect when knocked out, that is, there was no phenotypic effect, and those that had a very severe defect, shown in blue and in this brownish purple here. And then I looked in the yeast genome for paralogs, that is, duplicates similar to these genes, and simply counted the number of those. So for example, here, 14.9% of all genes on chromosome 5 that have no phenotypic defect when knocked out have one similar partners, paralogous gene in the yeast genome, whereas 26.1% of those with the most severe defect. Now, I don't really want to walk you through this whole graph. I really want to point only out these two bars. Okay, those are genes, correspond to genes that have no paralogs in the yeast genome. There is that they are single copy genes. Okay. And what one finds is that almost, well, more than 40% of knockouts in these genes have no phenotypic defect. Okay. Now, clearly, gene duplication cannot be responsible for this, because these are single copy genes. There are simply no paralogous genes there. Yet, when eliminating their function, there is no effect on the phenotypic level. So that finally convinced me that for the predominant part of these different perspectives taken together convinced me that for the predominant number of gene knockouts, the weak phenotypic effect cannot be caused by gene duplicates. Although this, I think, was the prevalent hypothesis if you ask anybody in the field at the time. Now, pardon? Which genes? Oh, they're all over the place. There is, you know, some of them, you have the usual problems that about 50% of them are completely uncharacterized, and a few of them have key functions in protein synthesis, like the ones on the table that I showed. But then there's other ones that have, you know, functions such as, you know, I don't know, actin assembly. There are some of them are transcription factors. So they're really functionally, there's no correlation between being clumped together in these blocks and doing something specific in the organism. In fact, if you can, I've actually looked at the genome plasticity in yeast after gene duplications. You can actually ask the question, if you duplicate a gene, therefore generate two genes that have similar functions, how long do the duplicates actually retain similar location in the genome? And it turns out genome plasticity is enormous. So very shortly after duplication, duplicates are elsewhere. Yes?
Did you want to make anything of the one-to-one copy
difference? Okay. Okay, let's just agonize over those a little bit. What about that? Oops. I was hoping, though, that I could move on because I have something to show you that I think is more interesting than all of this together. Okay. What were you going to ask about this?
I mean, you have a P of 0.001.
Yeah, well, what you could say is that, you know, for these genes that occur in very, very large families, okay, you could make the case that perhaps those genes that have no phenotypic effect are likely to be more closely associated with larger gene families, right? But here you see exactly the converse. Okay, I don't really want to overinterpret this whole slide because there's the fact that these distributions are different by a simple goodness of fit test, but the distribution is in no way different that you could easily interpret functionally. In this particular slide, I've actually been deliberately, because I use it only to illustrate this here, I've been deliberately very liberal. What you...
So being liberal goes against the analysis. In principle, you can change two amino acids out of 100, and it's completely different.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely. I've actually repeated this type of study with different cutoff levels of similarity. What you actually, because these kinds of analyses are computationally expensive, okay, you use in a first cut analysis what is called a blast score of genes. That is a score based on an algorithm that is very popular, a heuristic algorithm that is popular and fast to look for genes in other genomes. A blast score of 0.01 that I've used in this particular slide to generate this particular set of bars would actually detect gene pairs even if only small sections, you know, 20% or so of their amino acid sequence would overlap. Okay? You could actually, this is a very crude level of looking at this, okay? One can actually look at the distribution of similarities. So here you're actually comparing comparing genes, a gene that has been knocked out, to more than 9 other genes in the genome that are similar. So you can actually look at the distribution of similarities of the amino acid sequences in these families. And I've done part of that, and there's still no clearly detectable, interpretable difference here. Yes?
Yeah, I mean, one of the other things that may be a complication is the fact that maybe a whole bunch of the proteins with zero other copies are just rare because they're rather unimportant inherently. So I was wondering, if you were to just do a plot like this of...
Wait, hold on a second, because I'm not sure what I'm even buying the sort of the premise here. You say because the proteins are rare, they might be unimportant?
That for instance, that blue bar, the 43.6%, there may be a lot of proteins that are just not overly needed in experimental conditions. What I'm wondering about is if you were to do a restricted plot of this of only those proteins that have significant expression levels, then what you're doing is you're only looking at things that the cell has decided are important enough, and then you're looking at something that the cell has decided is important enough to express.
Okay.
But yet,
yeah, the problem with your premise is this, that you know, genes that might not be expressed at high levels are unimportant. Some people argue that the key regulators in cells will have extremely low concentrations.
Right. Okay. But on the other hand, I think if it's low expression levels, to say that it's not significant is difficult, but to say that if it has a significant expression level, it might be easier to say
that.
No, but what I'm saying is that the idea is that if the protein is expressed at some level, then it's more likely
to. But we need to ask about this guy. He has nothing to do with expression level.
No, but I'm saying if you only consider the protein, but then have significant expression levels, then there's a chance that you're restricting yourself to proteins that you have some indication are important for the cell under that.
He's just proposing a different way to look at the data, and I think it's a valid possibility. Just because I'm aware, I didn't do this analysis, quite frankly. So it will be something to look at. Given that there is no clear association with importance and expression level, I'm doubtful whether it would yield anything. But it's something that one could definitely look at.
Different definitions of what is similar versus dissimilar. A whole universe of different of possibilities of such a definition. There might be a point in that space in which there will be a best correlation to the knockout effect.
Yeah. And that's actually on a variety of other levels, you know, something that I'm really after. Where is that point? And there's not only you know, expression levels and sequence similarities are not the only thing. I will actually get to something else that may be important there. The critical problem, as you say, is, you know, where is that point? And is that a point that we can actually detect with the kind of data that genome technology, for example, genomic technologies actually gives us? Okay. Now, I want to get back now to a little bit to this question of how we might actually detect similar functions and compare functions of duplicate genes. We have discussed this already in the first part and also during the break, where I said, you know, really what I'm doing here is I'm cheating all the time. I'm saying, well, I'm really comparing sequence and expression pattern. I'm using that as a proxy for function. Now, the problem with functional annotation of genes, as I said, is really a very messy one. It is not clear how to classify gene functions, and it is absolutely not clear even for where there is classifications of gene functions, or good classifications, such as perhaps in a case of transcription factors, how to compare and quantify comparison among gene functions, let alone all the possible functions that that genes can have. You know, 30 years ago, life was really very simple, I presume, because one polypeptide had one function, and we have since learned that many genes are actually deployed in different contexts in an organism under different circumstances during different parts of the life cycle. And they sometimes have different biochemical function depending on what other genes are around. So to clearly define a function or how many functions a gene has in an organism is very, very critical. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to make a very simple proposition, a very crude way, just a suggestion of how we might look at gene functions and compare them. Something that relies on a recently published data set on a yeast protein interaction network and its evolution by gene duplication. And I'm saying it's a suggestion or proposition for two reasons. Well, for one main reason. There is some problems with this data set that is not free of errors, and we have difficulties estimating the error rate of these protein interactions that it identifies. And then I'm very well aware that it really neglects many aspects of gene function, and it is really there for just a crude look at the whole. So what I'm going to talk about first is the experimental assay generated to used to generate this data set, since many of you may not be familiar with it. And then talk a little bit about the data set itself, and then go back to the question of comparing gene functions and how much redundancy or similarity functions may really remain in such a network after gene duplication. Now, this is a eukaryotic transcription factor. It's a protein that has as its sole function to turn on the expression, the messenger RNA, transcription into messenger RNA of a eukaryotic gene. Eukaryotic transcription factors have one important characteristic, that is they contain two parts. There's two parts to this protein. One part called the DNA binding domain that is important and necessary to bind DNA near the gene that should be turned on. And the second domain is what is called the transcriptional activation domain. This is a domain that interacts with a very complicated biochemical machinery that is not shown here, but that we'll see approximately here, and promotes the activation of transcription. Both are necessary for activation of transcription. Now, what I will be talking about is, what I will explain now very briefly, is an important assay that is now really at the point of revolutionizing the way people look at protein-protein interactions in cells. It's called the yeast 2 hybrid assay. And what it is capable of doing is it is capable of detecting whether two proteins, call them just X and Y, interact in living cells. The assay relies on recombinant DNA technology to generate fusion proteins. One such fusion protein is a fusion between the DNA binding domain of the transcription factor and protein X, and the other such fusion is fusion between protein Y and the activation domain of the transcription factor. Now, if we put this kind of construct into a cell, it will not be able to promote the transcription of this gene. If we put this construct by itself into a cell, it will not be able to do so either because it lacks the DNA binding domain and will thus not be tethered to the gene, just float around in the cell. However, if we put both of these constructs into a cell, then if these two proteins interact, we will form this bridge-like structure where the DNA binding domain is fused to the hybrid X, which interacts and binds hybrid Y, which is fused to the activation domain, and therefore transcription will be promoted. If we can detect the transcription of this gene easily, for example, if the gene product gives the cell a distinct color or fluorescence and under UV light, etc., then we can detect this interaction. Now, this asks the question and answers the question whether two genes, two proteins, X and Y, interact in a cell. This kind of assay can actually be done for all pairwise combinations of protein interactions in a cell. There are some techniques that allow one to do that. I'll be happy to explain some of that later on. But as far as this talk is concerned, this is sort of technical detail. And I should say the only thing I want to say, this is very, very difficult to do. But it has been done, and has also been done for yeast, and a paper regarding this. The result of this study came out last February in last February in the journal Nature. And the main result, the main set of data in this paper is a very, very long table of pairwise interactions of proteins that have been detected by, according to this experiment. Utz, U-E-T-Z, Peter Utz. Let me see. Oh, this is actually, this is the first author, okay? The principal investigator is Stan Fields. Now, there is a number of caveats to these techniques that I just, to this technique that I just want to point out very, very briefly. For example, these constructs may misfold as part of the result of generating a chimeric protein, and that may either yield spurious interactions, that is, interactions that do not occur in vivo, or you may miss interactions due to this misfolding. Expressed fusion proteins may be toxic to a cell because they are fusion proteins. Then there are transient or weak interactions that may go undetected, but that is that is what a lot of techniques to detect protein interactions have in common. In fact, the two hybrid assay is one of the more sensitive techniques. However, there's a series of these caveats, problems with the assay, that suggest that the rate of false positive and false negative interactions can actually be quite high, and it's difficult to evaluate at this point. However, everything I'm going to tell you, this kind of study, by the way, has now been repeated two more times, and with slightly different experimental approach, and has now been supplemented also by protein interaction data that has been obtained by conventional methods. And everything that I'm going to tell you about really is robust with respect to looking at different available data sets. So there was pretty much not much of an analysis published in this original paper of this protein interaction network, right? And so I decided at some point to just take a look at the graph induced by this network, because this is obviously the most natural representation of this sort of data. What you have here is a graph that consists of dots which correspond to proteins. So the nodes of the graph are proteins. And the edges of these graphs correspond to protein interactions. That is, two of these nodes are connected by edges if the respective proteins interact. There is something that one sees very often in these sorts of graphs, that is, common occurrence in graph in the kinds of graphs that graph theorists study, is that there's a very large central component of this graph that is a connected subnetwork surrounded by many, many smaller subnets, in this case about 160 of them. Yeah. Now, one of the questions here is what is the biological significance of the fact that we have a fairly large central network here surrounded by these small subnetworks? That is very difficult to evaluate at this point. Part of the reason is that a lot of the genes in this network are previously completely uncharacterized. Okay. Turns out the network has predictive value in the sense that if you, for example, take a gene that interacts, take a protein that interacts with a number of other proteins. Let's say you take a protein that has some functional annotation in the database, and some of its interaction partners also are functionally annotated, then in a large fraction of the cases, more than 75% of the cases, you can actually predict correctly the functional annotation of the central protein from that of its interaction partners. Yes? No, it's not a tree. There's lots of cycles in there. This is, you know, don't read too much into this. It's just done by a graph embedding algorithm, but you'd probably see a lot of cycles in here, in the central core here.
What's the size of the central core in the number of nodes, and what's the average size on the outside?
The average size on the outside is of the order of four nodes. The central core contains about half of the nodes, about 500 out of 1,000 nodes. 500 out of 1,000, roughly.
So 1,000 were done.
Yes. No, actually, the genome was exhaustively screened. Okay, and this particular study detected roughly 1,000 nodes with, I believe, about 1,500 total interactions. So this graph is a rather sparse graph, not surprisingly. Yes? If the proteins that represent these two dots have been shown by this experiment to interact.
And there are a lot of two dots, pairs of dots, like lines.
Like these guys here. Yeah? I don't know the answer to that. These kinds of very small networks, sometimes consisting of, you might not even call this a network, obviously, consisting of two or three only proteins, have also been found in all these other studies. What's the functional?
I'm just asking why in space they seem to localize the pairs of proteins.
Oh, what you actually do to just represent, this is just really a picture without much information contained in it. It's just useful to illustrate, you know, the properties of this graph. The algorithm that it represents this graph simply tries to minimize the distances among points. So points that are pairs of proteins that are connected in that way will actually map closely in two-dimensional space.
What you're asking, why do you see so many pairs? And the answer is the smallest cluster is a pair. So you have quite a few pairs.
Yes, I understand that. But it seems to me that the numbers of 3, 4, and 5 is rather small compared to what one might popular.
Most of them will be in pairs, few larger, and this central one is extremely unusual and good.
But I think the other thing is that maybe the number of pairs may not look as strange if you also included all the singletons. So it's a little bit
those that don't need it because you don't include all the points that aren't connected to anything else. And from what we know, there are about 5,000 of them.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, go ahead.
In the previous experiments when you showed up connection, the nodes here, are they the hybrid, text and line, or are they the other type?
No, the nodes.
X and Y.
Yeah, the nodes correspond to X and Y. Okay. The what you call the outside nodes, is that the word you used? Is just part of the machinery that helps to detect the interaction between X and Y. All that is really interesting is the interaction. Right, exactly. Yeah. Now, yes.
It seems like almost all the nodes are connected up into one cluster.
About 50%.
Is that because of the way you filter the data, or does that reflect sort of a biological average of the connectivity of all the proteins?
Well, let me actually say this. There is, I mean, many of you are very familiar with this area, but there's a class of a very important graphs that graph theory study called random graphs, okay, where you have a number of nodes, let's say 1,000 nodes, and you connect, you pick two nodes at random and pick them out and connect them by an edge. Okay, and you do that until you have exhausted a pre-specified number of edges. Okay, and it turns out that in that case, you will actually get that sort of pattern for a limited edge range.
If you use exactly the number of 1.5 edges per node.
Yeah. The average component size, the average.
You said that there was 1,000.
Yeah.
So actually, 1,000 points are connected. It's not exactly what. And I think what Peter said is important here. You actually have 1,500 edges out of 6,000 nodes.
Yes. But no, but you have only 1,000 nodes that participate in the network. According to this experimental data, only 1,000 of these interactions were of a quality that you can actually detect with the approach. Now, this has been done, repeated in a different analysis. For example, one that just came out 3 weeks ago by a Japanese group, they find many more interactions. However, this global picture of a central large component surrounded by smaller subnets is quite is the same. Sorry, sir, you had a question and you didn't really get to ask it.
When you do this experiment, if the outside
the outside two things are different. So you have a different
There are some subtleties, okay, of that sort. For example, it depends. The result that you get sometimes depends on the structure of the promoter itself that you use. What particular type of gal promoter you use. So yeah, there are those issues with the experiment, like in any kind of experimental technique. You had a question.
Yeah, I had a question. Did they really explore every single pair? Because I presume that you have to, you have to repeat the experiment for every single pair of interactions. Mm-hmm. Or as you said, maybe I misunderstood you, that for each prey protein, they tried 24 targets or other way around.
No. What they actually did, okay, I would probably have to spend half an hour just to explain the details of the experiment. But what they did, what you are referring to, is they did not look for bait proteins that had more than 24 targets. So they made a cutoff at that. Okay, they did not analyze any more than those. However, I think this is very unlikely to be a confounding factor here for a reason that I'm going to explain in a second. Okay, and actually the reason why this is the reason why this is unlikely to be a confounding factor is because the network is so sparsely connected. There's very few nodes that have very high connectivity. Okay, there's however an issue there that relates to the possibility of experimental artifacts in these kinds of studies, where prey proteins, some bait proteins are apparently extremely sticky, and it's not quite clear whether they're sticky because of the way the experiment is done, or because of them being sticky in nature. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yes. There are some of them. Yeah. Let's postpone that for just one more slide. Okay. It's going to come up. Pardon? No, they looked at all of them. They looked at all these dopamine, 90% of them. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
No, they didn't pick. They didn't make that pick. Okay, they actually just looked at all of them. And I'll be happy to explain to you how this is done. This is not done in a pairwise assay. You're actually screening one chimera against the whole library of proteins. Okay. So on the surface, this kind of feature, actually, of this kind of graph seems very, very similar to that of what is commonly known as an Erdős-Sohnyi random graph. That is a graph where you simply connect pairs of nodes at random. This feature of central components surrounded by many other ones, smaller ones. However, if one looks at this of these networks carefully, and one can look actually at a number of characteristics of these graphs, characteristics such as clustering coefficient, that is an indicator of how clumpy the distribution of protein contacts is in the graph, or the mean path length among proteins, they're in almost all characteristics different from that of such a random graph. And I will only point out one such characteristic, because it's something that has gotten a lot of attention in the scientific and also in the popular press in the last few years, and it is the fact that the distribution of protein contacts, that is the number of proteins with a given number of interaction partners, number of interaction partners shown here, number of proteins with this number of interaction partners shown on the y-axis, follows roughly a power law with an exponent of 2.5. Okay. This is something that has also been observed, for example, in metabolic networks, which a collaborator and myself and independently a group at Notre Dame University analyzed last year, although the exponent is slightly different. And it has also been observed, as many of you may know, in a variety of other systems outside, and a variety of other graphs outside biology. One could speculate a lot about what the significance of that might be. My personal speculation on this is that it's just an indication of a very general type of random process that produces these sorts of networks. Yes? Yes.
Functional relationships.
Yeah.
Because many of these proteins carefully
separated. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's actually something that I have an idea how that could be tested and something that I will be looking at. I don't really think, there are some people who argue that this kind of structure endows a graph with robustness. And I don't really buy into these kinds of functional arguments because they usually neglect a lot of what we know about the biology of these systems. I think a hypothesis like the one that you put forth is much more likely to hit the target. Of. Okay.
Is this the real data?
Yes, the real data.
So is this not what is expected for random graphs?
For an Erdős-Rényi random graph, so this is the random graph that I talked about, you actually would have a distribution of contacts that would drop off like this. It would have a much...
Yeah, for random graphs.
What's
so? But it really that work.
Right, right, exactly, right. But notice that there is a very small number of nodes that are even out here at 10 interactions. And in, by the way, you know, you can redo this analysis with all the data sets that are out there, and it's pretty much the same result. The exponent varies by only about 10 to 15%. Pardon? Well, that, you know, that critically depends on the experiment that you're looking at. You know, it may be in the most recent experiment, there are about 2,500 of those. In the original experiment, there were 5,000 of those. Okay, so would not fall on that line. Yeah. Now, we could talk a lot about the structure of this graph. One of the things that my lab will be doing in the next year or so is actually try to find biologically meaningful models that could explain the structure of this graph. Emphasis being on biologically meaningful. However, what I want to go back to now very quickly is actually the analysis of this graph and how it relates to the process of gene duplication. Imagine you have a protein that is part of this network and it interacts with four other proteins. You duplicate the gene that encodes this protein, and immediately after the duplication, you have two identical gene products, two identical proteins, and therefore they all interact with the same four proteins here. However, after these genes have accumulated mutations, therefore differences in their amino acid and DNA sequence, some of these interactions, most of these interactions may actually get lost. And occasionally new interactions might get formed. Okay. For all we know about, anecdotally, about the prevalence of degenerative mutations over mutations generating new interactions, it's not unreasonable to assume that the process of loss of interactions is more abundant, occurs more frequently than new interactions being formed. And here is the proposition. And really, it's just a proposition, and feel free to reject it. I think, however, that it's the only kind of approach that will give us a handle on comparing gene functions of duplicate genes. What if we actually take the overlap in these common interactions as an indicator of redundancy in function or similarity in function? That is, if we call two genes whose products have a large number of all interactions, all contacts in common, might be very similar in function, whereas a situation like this, where these two genes have only one out of many interactions in common, we might call this similar in function. And we can actually look at this problem with relation to this graph. So we actually have a lot of protein contacts that have been experimentally studied in this, with this kind of assay. We have information about gene duplications. We can just put these two together and look what's really happening in this sort of graph. By the way, there we have also the possibility of multiple duplications here, namely that there is, let's say there's one protein interacts with another protein, the gene encoding it undergoes four duplication, and you would see these kind of bundles then of interactions in the graph. So this is now these two types of information superimposed. This is the original protein interaction network. This is also the network, but two proteins are connected in red by red lines. If they are products of duplicate genes. Yeah. And what you see already here is that this this network of lines crisscrosses the graph. That is, it doesn't stay really localized within one region of the graph, which is already an indication of what's to come, namely that duplicate genes often do not have common interactions. For example, this is just a subsection of this graph. It turns out that these bundles of interactions radiating out from a central spoke are really quite abundant in the graph. That is, the graph is full of them, and this is exactly what you'd expect if, for example, this gene, the gene encoding this protein here, has been duplicated 4 times and interacts with this common partner still. So you might think that this is a result of gene duplications, right? But this is not what you observe. If you look at almost all of these bundles, the red lines really bypass them. Okay? They don't really connect as you would expect genes at the periphery of such a bundle. Now, how to put this, how to actually make this kind of analysis more comparative, more quantitative? This is really just a more or less illustrative picture of the graph. What one can do is one can group gene duplicates now according to their age, according to their divergence along synonymous sites. So this is, again, this quantifier, the number of synonymous substitutions per synonymous site for each of these, for each of a group of gene duplicates in this graph. So this would be a KS between 0 and 0.5, between 0.5 and 1, etc. KS equals 1 corresponding to about 100 million years, 100 million years since divergence. What is shown on the y-axis here is the fraction of duplicates that share some common interaction partner. I'm not even counting the number of interactions that they share. So, I'm not even counting, you know, whether this is a one shared interaction here or not. I'm just saying, do two duplicates have shared interactions, such as in this case, or do they have no shared interaction partners at all? And it turns out that even for the youngest group of duplicates here, only about 55% of duplicate genes actually have shared interactions. Right? What is shown here as this solid black line indicated by the arrow is what I call the random expectation. That is, if you pull two proteins at random out of this graph, what is the probability that they share an interaction? That they have a shared interaction partner. It's really fairly low because the graph is rather sparse. And stars indicate here the divergence. I'm sorry, whether the difference from this random expectation is statistically significant. So what one sees here is that within the already the youngest class of duplicates doesn't really have a whole lot of shared interactions. Only 50% of these proteins have common interaction partners, and that number dwindles further. Till it hits the random expectation at a KS of about 2. I'm well aware that these kinds of values of KS are very problematic to even use. Again, I argue that I'm using it only to coarsely group gene duplicates in different...
Presumably you're missing some of these interactions in your data set.
Mm-hmm.
So you estimated how big the 55% could be if you add...
The thing is this, what you're referring to is, you know, how sensitive is this to false positive and false negative interactions in a data set? The problem is we can't really estimate this at this point. However, one thing that is very important to realize is that all the studies that have been done, all the different data sets, different approaches, and some of them actually using conventional techniques to identify protein interactions, so a different style of study, produce that result. Okay, so I've reanalyzed the data sets that are out there with respect to this, and you find something qualitatively similar. In fact, for example, the most recent data set just came out. This should actually be 2001. Just came out 3 weeks ago. Here's a graph shown for something for very, very, very similar layout of the graph. Grouping of duplicate genes into categories on the x-axis, the y-axis, the duplicates with shared interactions. In this case, even the youngest class doesn't really have a lot of shared interactions. So we don't even have the 55% that you saw in the previous slide. It's only about 10% that have shared interactions. Now, There's a lot more things that I could tell you about this. There, it turns out that there, one can look at this also with the distribution of duplicates across different subnets, or the mean path length of duplicates. But quite frankly, we've been going over 2 hours. I'm getting tired, and as the questions, the number of questions per minute decreases, I assume you, so you do you, and I'll postpone the rest for further discussion after the talk. All I want to say in conclusion is that if we accept that this kind of, this way of looking at redundancy, at a crude look of looking at overlapping gene functions, has any value, then we have to conclude that redundant gene functions, contrary to expectations of most molecular biologists, or at least the expectations of these of this group, of this community until a couple of years ago, are not at all as prevalent as one might suppose. Thank you.
Yeah. Why are you using KS on your exam?
Because KA is not a good, you know what KA is? Yeah, is
KA would actually tell you whether the proteins were similar or
they tell you whether they're similar in amino acid sequence, okay? They don't tell you how much time has gone by since the duplication. Not at all, because the correlation, because what it reflects really is what kind of constraints a protein is under. And that, in part, depends on structural features of the protein. There are actins, proteins that interact, that form large polymers of proteins. But then you're not really measuring. I see what you're saying. Yes, but then you're not really measuring what I'm after here. How fast do common interactions disappear after duplication?
Yeah, but the first step is to just show that the things that are similar have the same interaction. That would be a way of working out how much error there is in the experiment.
Actually, that's a good suggestion. Well, what I can tell you, for example, this is, I've not done this with respect to KA, but, let's just go through the whole thing. You cannot absolutely say how much error there is in the experiment, but I've prepared a slide on data quality that I normally show that I just didn't get to, get to. In the most recent data set that also incorporates a lot of the independently confirmed interactions, you find that there is nine relatively young gene duplicates, okay, that have a KS of less than 0.1, corresponding roughly to less than 10 million years since duplication. They have a total of 46 interactions, 23 of which are shared. Okay. Now, some people argue, for example, that the fact that this graph has features of that has in common with a random graph argues that this whole approach is not even worth pursuing because it generates data that is completely junk, basically. Now, this kind of pattern suggests otherwise. For example, if you pull two proteins out of random and calculate the numerically the probability that they have shared interactions, it would be found to be about 0.008. To have 23 out of 46 shared interactions, the probability of that is just astronomically small if you were to generate this data by chance alone. Now, what you also have to take into account here is that the half-life of duplicates, that these genes have been duplicated a while ago. And in yeast, you actually have a half-life of duplicated genes that is, when you look at gene silencing, about 10 million years. Okay? So this is now not about the decay of protein interactions, just about gene silencing. It takes about 10 million years till one out of two duplicates is eliminated from the genome on average after duplication.
By a random elimination?
Yeah. 90% of all duplicates are eliminated from the genome after the original duplication.
By a mistake, if you like, rather than by a mistake which didn't get corrected because it didn't matter.
Right, by a null mutation.
Yeah,
you eliminate only one of the two, yes. And so this is the half-life of duplicated yeast genes. If protein interactions decay only at an approximately similar rate, Okay, as null mutations occur, they may actually might decay at a much faster rate because most of the mutations that occur are actually not null mutations, but they are mutations that are slightly deleterious and may affect only part of what a protein does or what a gene product does. If they only occurred at an approximately similar rate, what you would actually expect is exactly what you see here, that half of these common interactions are still around after 10 million years. Now, I realize this is really a back-of-the-envelope sort of argument. But what it suggests, at least, is that the kind of data that we have is not of ludicrously bad quality, and beyond that, we can actually not really say very much.
But the 10 million years where the half-life of decay would involve things like stop coding and things like that.
Everything.
Right, yeah. Which may be very much unrelated to the process in terms of losing interactions.
Yeah. The question is, you know, would it occur at a lower or a higher rate? Okay, I would argue that it might actually, loss of protein interactions might actually occur at a higher rate. But, you know, that's arguable. Yes? Pardon?
How is that?
You basically determine what are called survivorship curves of gene duplicates. It's not something that I have done. There was a paper in late 2000 by Lynch and Connery in Science that did these kinds of calculations for a variety of genomes. And basically what you're looking at is the number of gene duplicates that are still around after a certain amount of divergence has accumulated between them. So you're actually not looking at the ones that are dead, gene duplicates that have been eliminated, but the ones that are still around. So this is an indirect estimate made on that basis.
How did you scramble the network to produce the
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is, you know, something I don't even want to get into, the question of how robust are the kinds of graph characteristics that we measure to false positive and false negative interactions. And I would argue that it's reasonably robust, and you should not even study anything that is not robust to scrambling at least 20% of interactions. Yeah. But it's actually in a number of other things. For example, the clustering coefficient is not extremely sensitive either. So there are some global characteristics that that are reasonably robust.
So when you look at it network,
Well, you know, there is a number of things that you can actually look at. You could, for example, look at the degree distribution of the network. So you could ask the question are proteins that are more highly connected more sensitive to knockouts in their respective genes, right? And it turns out that there's a weak statistical signal in there, okay? But it is not something that could explain the data sets that we have fully. It explains some of the variation across genes, but not all of it. That's the problem with a lot of these genome scale data sets. You know, there is some weak statistical signals in there, but it's not the one thing that you're looking for. And maybe the data that we have right now doesn't provide the one thing that you're looking for.
Have you or anyone compared the divergence from any, maybe it's the right measure, the divergence of promoter regions?
I have looked at this very briefly, actually, in one afternoon in the case of yeast, and found that promoter regions diverge actually much faster than the coding regions. What I've actually done more closely, I've looked at the question of is there a correlation between divergence in sequence and divergence in expression pattern? So genes that are more diverged in sequence, are they also more diverged in expression pattern? And that was something I published in PNAS last year, and the answer is no. There is at most a very weak correlation, with the caveat that there is noise in the data, a lot of noise in the expression data. Well, thank you very much. It was certainly stimulating. Thank you.